talk on the Buddha's teaching on community by Vajragupta today. I'm very much looking forward to this being developed, and we'll have a chance to carry on these conversations. I hope beyond this retreat, as we meet up together in different contexts. So when you're ready, I'll hand over to you, Vajragupta. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Moksha Darshini, and good morning, everyone. So yesterday I talked about creating Sangha as a gift to each other, and that was based around the Buddha's teaching of the Sanghavastus. Today, mainly in the second half of the talk, I'm going to talk about creating Sangha as a gift to the world. So saying something about the relationship of a Buddhist Sangha to the wider community, to the wider society, to the wider world. But before I do that, I'm just going to present you a model of Sangha. I guess it's a model that talks about the kind of inner dynamics of a Sangha and how a Sangha works as a whole. And then right at the end of the talk, I'll link those two themes together. I'll try and show what that model means for Sangha as a gift to the wider world, as it were. So first of all, this model of Sangha, I'm just going to share something with you on the screen. Oh, it says the host disabled participant screens show. Can you make me the host, Moksha Darshini?
Yes. I have said that participants can share screen now.
Oh, okay, thank you. That's great. So there we go. I'm just going to talk you through this. So on the left-hand side, you've got lay followers, monastics, and forest renunciants. So this is a description of kind of three tiers to the Sangha, maybe in the Buddha's time, or perhaps towards the end of the Buddha's life, or just after the Buddha's time, when the Buddhist Sangha was becoming established. So what you had back in those times was there was what you could call the forest renunciants. So these were people who left society. They just wandered off into the forests, into the jungles, and they lived quite an austere life of meditation, really deeply going into meditation. So a life very focused on personal Dharma practice, deep, intense meditation, trying to gain insight, trying to really transform the mind deeply, trying to plumb the depths of the mind and plumb the depths of meditation, as it were. And in the Buddha's time, there were plenty of people who practiced in that way. That's how they lived out their Buddhist life. That's how they became followers of the Buddha. And then you also had the monastics, so the monks and the nuns, and they sort of tended to live on the edge of towns, on the edge of villages, and eventually they started forming kind of maybe what we'd call monasteries. They would have dwelling places, like little retreat centres, and they would go into the towns and the villages to teach people, also to collect alms. So they kind of practiced. They were definitely immersing themselves in Buddhist practice, but they were also very much interacting with the world, interacting with the surrounding society. They were also doing things like, I suppose eventually, this is sometime later after the Buddha, writing down the teachings, preserving the teachings in written form, and so on. So, kind of creating the tradition, preserving, creating the kind of institutions and the tradition, as it were. That was the role of the monastics. That's how they sort of lived out their Buddhist life. And then you had the lay followers. So these were the people, living in society, working, farming, bringing up families, and so on. And they would support the monastics. They would give money and food to support the monastics. They would also practice the teachings. And yeah, they were very much kind of embedded in society. So that's a model of what the Buddhist Sangha looked like. Maybe not straight away, but once it was a sort of established and set up, as it were, with these three kind of tiers, three kind of different ways, three lifestyles, if you like, three different ways you could pursue the Buddha's teachings. And in a way, what we're trying to do now, in a very, very different time, a very, very different cultural context, is recreate something a bit like that. This is what Tri Ratna is trying to recreate in a certain kind of way. There's some quite important differences. So one of the things about monastics is, well, they were monastic, they were monks, they were celibate. And we've got a different model to that. To be ordained in our order, you don't have to be a monastic. You can be a lay follower and also be ordained, as it were. So the model that we're trying to create isn't exactly the same, but there are definitely certain overlaps. And certainly in terms of this model, there's a quite clear overlap. So, yeah, some people in Tri Ratna, the wider Tri Ratna, do live a more retreatant lifestyle, yeah, a bit like the forest renunciates. So we have got, you know, people in our order, people in our movement, who spend a lot of time on retreats, maybe going off for retreats for a year or 3 years, sometimes coming back. I've seen a few order members give talks immediately after getting back off long retreats and really sort of feeling them bringing something back, something kind of deep, some kind of deep inspiration that they bring back and share, and then that kind of feeds into the wider Sangha. So we've got a few people living a kind of retreatant like lifestyle. And then we've got Sangha builders. So I suppose I would be an example of a Sangha builder. I work at the Buddhist Centre. So I don't have a job in the world. I don't have a family or anything like that. I'm kind of living in the Buddhist world. I'm living in Tri Ratna, working within Tri Ratna, trying to help create the kind of institutions, if you like, or the organisations where the Dharma can flourish, where people can discover the Dharma, discover the Sangha, and so on. So that's the Sangha builders. And there's, again, like the monastics, they're sort of halfway between those that are kind of retreating from society, kind of leaving society, or stepping back. They're halfway between those and then the people that are very much fully in society. So the third tier in this model is the Dharma citizens. I don't quite like these names. I was trying to sort of think of names for them, and this was the best I could come up with. But yes, sort of Dharma citizens. So people that are very much their citizens, they're out there in society, but they're trying to make that the way that they live out their Dharma life, trying to embody and exemplify and practice the Dharma in the world, yeah? So maybe bringing up families, trying to do that in a Dharmic way, perhaps working in the world, perhaps being a teacher, or running a business and trying to do that ethically, or maybe being an activist for some kind of social cause. All sorts of ways people sort of practice the Dharma out there in the world, as citizens, as members of society, as it were. So you've got these three ways, three lifestyles, if you like, very, very broadly speaking. Three ways of being part of the Sangha and practicing the Dharma in the world. Yeah. And then you see also I've put there breadth and depth. So I think this is part of what this model shows, is that how actually we all support each other in our practice. So you've got some people who are helping to ensure the kind of depth of the Sangha, ensure that there's kind of deep inspiration coming in, deep meditation, real kind of depth of connection with the Dharma. And then you've also got other people who are sort of ensuring that there's breadth, that the whole thing doesn't kind of get disconnected from the wider society, that it's part of the wider society, contributing to the wider society, that it's sort of facing out into the world and connecting with other people. So yeah, it's a kind of model of how the Sangha works and how all of us in our own ways can make a contribution. All of us in our own ways can choose one of these ways of living and practicing, and that contributes to the overall health and the overall balance and the overall dynamic of the Sangha. Some of us are helping to ensure the depth and the vitality in that sense. Some are helping to ensure the breadth and the kind of connection with the wider society. And yeah, these three categories aren't numerically equal. So there's probably relatively few people living as retreatants and even Sangha builders. Probably most people are out there in the world living their life, trying to live their life, their Dharma life in all sorts of different ways. And it's not a static model. So people might change through their life. They might do different things at different phases in their life. So for example, when people get ordained, they often go off on a long retreat for 3 months or 4 months. They get ordained in the context of being a retreatant, just having some time to really, really immerse themselves very fully, very intensively, very one-pointedly in the Dharma and in meditation and Dharma study and so on. So, yeah, people can do different phases at different times in their life. And also, these three categories aren't entirely sort of discrete and separate. So somebody like Moksha Darshini, for instance, she's a Sangha builder. She's working at the Buddhist Centre. She's the Mitra convener. She's very much involved in creating the Sangha here and supporting the institution that is trying to create the Sangha here. And at the same time, she's a mum. She's got a family that she's bringing up. So she's also a kind of Dharma citizen involved in the world, involved in the society around her. So yeah, they're not kind of discrete and separate categories. But I think what it's giving you is, yeah, a bit of a model of how the Sangha works and the kind of inner dynamic of a Sangha. How a Sangha overall allows for and supports both depth and breadth. And that there are different ways of participating in a Sangha, different ways of contributing, different lifestyles that you can lead. And they all play a role. They all support each other. Yeah. So, yeah, the danger of being a Dharma citizen is you're out there in the world and your practice can get kind of diluted. You can just get maybe overwhelmed or distracted by the busyness and all the stuff of the world. So that's why the Sangha builders and the retreatants provide something which can support you, which can help you maintain enough connection with depth and so on. But you also make a contribution by being out there and out in the world, exemplifying the Dharma, communicating the Dharma out there, being in touch with the wider society so that the Sangha doesn't sort of, yeah, just get out of touch, get disconnected from what's actually going on in the world. So yes, there's sort of potential weaknesses in any one lifestyle, but overall there's a kind of strength. Overall we can support each other, counterbalance the different strengths and weaknesses, and provide something that has got the necessary breadth and the necessary depth. Yeah. So in a way this links back to the idea I mentioned yesterday of we can't be Avalokiteshvara. I can't be Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, by myself. But I can be a hand of Avalokiteshvara. I can be part of the Bodhisattva. So in a way, this is a model which, you know, in a particular way, is showing how the Sangha together can be the Bodhisattva, providing something which has really got breadth and depth. Yeah. And yeah, this model provides a sort of, yeah, kind of vision of what we're trying to create in the Croydon Buddhist Centre, but also in Tri Ratna as a Buddhist movement as a whole. It's what we're trying to create for ourselves and for the world. Yeah. So I'm going to leave that model there for now, and I'll come back to it later. And now I'm going to say something about, the relationship of the Sangha to the wider community, the wider society, the wider world. And I guess I particularly want to try and say something about this. I mean, it's a huge topic, but I wanted to try and say something about it because in many ways the world does seem in a dark place in recent years. It just feels like the whole kind of system is creaking and straining at the edges, and almost you could imagine that the thing kind of collapsing sometimes. We've had a whole process of globalisation in the last 20, 30, 40 years, and that has caused massive changes in the world, and some people have just been left behind by those changes, and I think that's led to things like populism in different parts of the world. We had the financial crash in 2008 and the whole period of austerity, which has profoundly impacted on people's lives. There are kind of ecological problems, not just global warming, but all sorts of ecological challenges that the human race is facing. There are places where democracy seems to be under threat. There are lots of places in the world where just, the public discourse, the public space, seems more polarised, more divided, more fractious. And then on top of that, there's this pandemic going on, which just adds a whole other layer of strain and complexity and stress onto all of these problems. And sometimes it seems like the politicians just don't know what to do. They don't really have any answers. The system seems, just kind of teetering and fragmented. So what does Buddhism have to say about that? Does Buddhism have anything to offer this kind of troubled world? I just want to share a few reflections on that topic this morning. Of course, it's a big topic, so these are only just a few starting reflections. The first thing I want to say is that Buddhism isn't left or right. I think this is quite important, that Buddhism, we shouldn't be party political at the Buddhist Centre. I want the Croydon Buddhist Centre to be open to everybody, to be open to people with a range of political views, and not for it to be that people come along and feel they're not welcome for whatever reason. The Buddhist Centre has got to be open to everybody. I remember a few years ago when there was the Scottish independence vote. I knew a woman that was going to one of the Scottish Buddhist centres. She was English, and she felt quite neutral about the independence referendum. She sort of, her feeling was, I don't have strong feelings about it, I just think this is up, this is for the Scottish people to decide. So she was kind of neutral. But a lot of the older members at the Buddhist Centre, who were leading the Buddhist Centre, were really into the independence cause. And they basically were, her perception was that the Buddhist Centre became a sort of campaigning centre for Scottish independence for several weeks leading up to the referendum. And she sort of felt like that if you weren't into that cause, you weren't quite welcome at the Buddhist Centre. So when I heard that, I thought that was wrong actually, that they'd sort of lost perspective. And in a way, the Dharma had got relegated. Only for a few weeks, but for that period, the Dharma sort of took second place and something else had sort of taken first place in the Buddhist Centre. And of course that shouldn't happen. We don't want that happening at the Buddhist Centre. The Dharma always needs to be in first place. So I think this is an important principle, that we recognise that people can be Buddhists, they can be genuine Buddhists, they can be genuinely imbibing Buddhist values and principles, living those out, and then from that they can quite honestly and genuinely come to a range of political positions. And we have to kind of allow for that and recognise that. But then that leads to a further question. Well, does that then mean, as Buddhists, we just sit on the fence and we don't say anything? Or as a Buddhist Sangha, we just sit on the fence and don't say anything about what's going on in the world? So my answer to that is no, and I've got two reasons. So firstly, I think we can speak our minds freely as individual Buddhists. You're completely free to say what you think about a number of issues, to advocate for things, to campaign and be an activist for causes that you feel passionate about, to try and persuade others, and so on. You're completely free to do that. And it's good that you do that in a kind of thoughtful, creative, skillful kind of way. Yeah. What you can't do is you can't say that's the Buddhist position. But you're completely free to say, well, this is the position I've taken as a Buddhist. But we can't claim to be representing the Buddhist position. But I think, yeah, it's really great if people do that, if they are active citizens, if they do get involved in issues and campaigns that they feel passionate about and, yeah, really kind of offer something to the wider society in that way. And maybe there's space in the Buddhist Centre for more kind of debate and dialogue and creating a space where we can sort of hear about these issues and try and consider them from a Buddhist point of view. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then I'd say, secondly, collectively, we can talk about the values and principles that would be embedded in a good society. We can talk more on a kind of principial level about what a decent society might look like. And we can talk about how Dharma principles, Dharma values, might play a role in that, might contribute to a kind of decent society, a good society. So yeah, I think although we can't be party political as a Sangha, I think we can talk on a more kind of principial level about the values and the principles which underpin a decent human good society. So I want to kind of explore that with reference to three areas, so three sort of Buddhist values that I think also say something about society, about the state of the world. Yeah? So three Buddhist values, which aren't just sort of personal individual values. I think there's a dimension of them which is also a kind of social, even a political value, if you like. Yeah? So the first one, and the main one that I want to talk about, is metta, loving kindness. Yeah, and my strapline here is, yeah, loving kindness. We share common humanity and potential. So one thing that we've seen in the world in the last 40 years is a massive growth in inequality. So through most of the 20th century, societies in Europe and America and, you know, those kinds of societies were getting more equal. And then that's reversed in the last 40 years. And apparently the levels of inequality, particularly in Britain and America, are now back to what they were in the 19th century. A massive social change that has taken place in our lifetimes. And yesterday I was talking about my brother, who's a postman in South London, and I was talking about the world that he lives in, his daily reality of being, I suppose, basically being in a world of power. Power relationships, a world where the communication isn't real communication. You're not really seen, you just get these rather sort of corporate communications which don't bear any resemblance to your reality, to the kind of reality of what's going on in your working life. And sort of, yes, just sort of being in a world of power relations and feeling a bit taken for granted and not listened to in a certain kind of way. And I think this is the daily experience of millions and millions of people. And they've probably got so used to it that they just think it's normal. And that's how life is, as it were. But of course, if you're in that situation, you feel unheard, you feel undervalued, then it becomes harder to listen to other people and value other people. You tend to kind of withdraw into your own world or your own group, as it were. Yeah? And it becomes harder to really hear other people. A few weeks ago, I read a book by Elif Shafak. She's a novelist. I've never read any of her novels, though she's a prize-winning novelist. But she's just written this book called How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division. How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division. It's just a very short little book. Really recommend it. And this is one of her themes. She says that in our modern world, there's so many people who feel not listened to, who feel undervalued, who feel no one kind of understands their situation. And she says, stories bring us together. Untold stories keep us apart. So that's part of her view of things. She just thinks there's so many people who have untold stories, who feel not valued, not listened to, and their stories are never heard. And that kind of keeps us apart. If you feel not listened to, you just stop listening and you withdraw into your own little kind of world or your own kind of nationality or your own kind of group, and you stop listening to other people. And this is dangerous because it creates a society where there isn't a kind of common shared space, but there's just more and more polarisation, more and more people just living on the internet within the kind of echo chambers where they're just fed more and more of the kind of news and views that they're going to agree with, and so on. Kind of really describes something about our current situation, I think. Just the other day I was reading an article in the newspaper by a woman who's just written a book about carers and caring. So she interviewed hundreds of people that care, that do caring work. People that do it for family members, people that are professional carers, and so on. She just interviewed them and talked to them about caring. And apparently, a typical interview would start off with something like the person saying, well, I'm just a carer, I haven't really got anything to say. And then she would sort of talk to them and draw them out. And eventually they would be talking about their work and why they cared so much about it and the kind of values of compassion that they were trying to sort of live out. And then they would, at a certain point, they would sort of really sort of stop and feel surprised of what they were talking about, and feel surprised that there was so much there that they felt so strongly about and were so animated about. And then she said quite often they'd say, God, I've never talked about this before. Nobody's ever asked me about this before. So it was just a little thing in the newspaper, but I found it rather moving. Again, you just got this sense of untold stories of so many people out there trying to live a good life, and they've never had a kind of chance to talk about it. No one's ever listened to them, as it were. So yes, I'm painting a picture of a world, where we've seen in recent years increased polarisation, increased division, increased kind of fractiousness in the public space, a world of more and more blame and resentment, a world of people living in echo chambers on the internet rather than a kind of shared cultural space where we really get to kind of listen to each other and hear each other's stories and hear arguments from the other side, as it were. And I think this is a problem. I think this creates a kind of spiritually sick society, as it were. So I've got here a quote from James Baldwin. A quote, I guess, written in the 60s. It's from a book called The Fire Next Time. He's a brilliant writer. So I guess he wrote this the early 60s in America at the start of the civil rights movement. And this is what he said. The political institutions of any nation are always menaced and are ultimately controlled by the spiritual state of the nation. The political institutions of any nation are always menaced and are ultimately controlled by the spiritual state of the nation. So yeah, I think he wrote that in the early 60s, but that is extremely relevant in America right now, I would say. Yeah? The political institutions of any nation, they're kind of underpinned, they have kind of roots in the spiritual state of a nation. Yeah? And this is something that Dr. Ambedkar, who's a very important figure in treatment now, really understood. So Ambedkar was born as a so-called untouchable in India, right at the bottom of the caste system, suffering the most inhumane discrimination and treatment, at school having to sit at the back of the classroom. If they gave him a drink, they wouldn't let the cup touch his lips because it would be polluting. The water was just poured into his mouth. The most, you know, horrible inhuman treatment that went along with untouchability, so-called untouchability. And he was an extraordinary figure who campaigned all his life against the caste system, the discrimination of the caste system. And there's no time to tell the story now, but if you don't know the story, read the life story of Ambedkar. Quite extraordinary man, quite extraordinary achievement. When India became independent in the 1950s, 54 was it, he actually became the law minister, the first law minister of the new independent India, and it was him that framed the new constitution for the Republic of India. And through doing that, he was able to outlaw untouchability in certain ways and pass certain laws which really improved the condition of the untouchables. But despite having achieved so much, he felt that it wasn't enough. Eventually, he actually resigned as the law minister because he felt there were certain things that the government wasn't willing to confront, wasn't willing to change. And he realised, I think he'd realised this all his life, but he kind of came to a kind of final realisation that political change wasn't enough. And that actually caste was a kind of spiritual sickness. It was something that was in people's heads, in people's minds, and in people's hearts. And what was needed was a deeper transformation. What was needed was a transformation, a deeper transformation of mind and heart. And yeah, this was true across the board. It was true in the case of the high caste Indians who were kind of doing the oppressing. They needed to kind of change their attitudes. But it was equally true for the people at the bottom. They'd sort of internalised those attitudes over centuries, over thousands of years of the caste system. They'd kind of taken it on board and didn't value themselves. And so Ambedkar realised that a spiritual revolution was needed, a spiritual transformation. And what he did was he converted to Buddhism. Towards the end of his life, he converted to Buddhism, and eventually millions of his followers also became Buddhists in order to kind of change their minds and change their hearts, in order to bring about that spiritual, personal transformation. So there's this whole movement in India of people using Buddhism and the kind of dignity that comes from the Buddhist vision and the Buddhist practices, using that to kind of uplift themselves and overcome centuries of oppression, centuries of degradation, and so on. So yeah, very, very inspiring example of how real social change, real political change, has to be rooted in a kind of spiritual transformation, a spiritual vision of what it means to be a human being, and really being able to kind of make that happen and live that out. So we've got this beautiful ideal of metta, loving kindness. And we talk about that sometimes in terms of friendliness and loving kindness and so on. But in a way deeper than that, what metta means is recognising and living from our common humanity. Our common humanity. Seeing that the pain that I suffer is the same that the pain of the same kind of pain that other people suffer. Seeing that, yeah, our pain and suffering is the same pain and suffering. Yeah? And likewise seeing that the joy that I feel and the happiness that I feel is the same as the joy and the happiness that other beings can feel, other people can feel. And the potential that I have to grow and become more awake and more enlightened is the same potential that everybody shares. So yes, within this quality of metta, within this idea of friendliness and loving kindness, is actually an idea of shared humanity, common humanity, that we're all the same in a certain kind of way, that we've all got a kind of potential, a human potential, which is incredibly precious and important. So by practicing metta, we're trying to relate to people, trying to relate to the world on the basis of that common humanity, on the basis of that common worth, common respect for everybody, whoever they are, wherever they are. Yeah. So it's a kind of equality. And I'm using that word carefully because that word has all sorts of meanings in the political sphere. But I'm meaning a kind of equality of humanity, equality of respect, yeah? Equality of basic human value. Yeah? And I'm saying that if we're going to have a society which, well, treats people well, with respect, values people, listens to people, it has to be based on that kind of spiritual roots, that kind of spiritual value. I quoted Simone Weil yesterday. Her most famous book is called The Need for Roots, that a good society needs to be rooted, underpinned in some kind of spiritual foundation, some kind of spiritual values about what it really means to be a human being, what it really means to live a good human life. If you want to know what a good society is, first of all, you have to know what a good human life looks like. What is the kind of value of a human life? And yeah, all that is kind of embedded in this ideal of metta that we have. Metta isn't just a kind of personal thing. It's not just about me and my relationships with those immediate and around me. This metta is about certain kind of values which have all sorts of social, even political implications. It's about the world. It's about the values which underpin society and community and the world, as it were. So I just want to read you a quote that I found recently from Nelson Mandela. So he said, "No one is born hating another person because of the colour of their skin, or their background, or their religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." So that's what he said. And I guess, in a way, that's one of the things that we're trying to offer society. We've got this wonderful transformational practice called the Metta Bhavana, which is all about learning to love. We're trying to, through the Metta Bhavana practice, trying to unlearn our hatreds. And maybe we feel we don't have any strong hatreds, but of course we've all got likes and dislikes, certain kind of fears, maybe certain kind of prejudices and limitations, maybe certain sort of stereotypical views that we pick up from society and become part of how we see people and how we relate to people in the world. So through this practice of the Metta Bhavana, we're just trying to sort of look honestly at all of that and unlearn it and try to be more open and kindly and loving towards other people. It's a really kind of radical, spiritually transformational tool. And again, it's not just about me and my relationship with the people around me. It's actually about the kind of world that we want to live in, the kind of society that we want to create, and the kind of values that underpin that society. So that's, I think, one way in which what we're doing as Buddhists, it's not just about us and our practice and our community, it's really speaking to what's going on in the world. So I'm going to mention two other areas, and I'm going to mention these more briefly. So firstly, secondly, my strapline here is community. We need something bigger than us to serve and to work for. So the ideal of community and having something bigger than us to serve and to work for us. So I remember a few years ago reading quite a bit about the psychology of happiness. So there's a whole recent growing area of studying the psychology of happiness. And basically what the psychologists have discovered is that after people get their needs met to a certain extent, so people do have certain needs and a certain need for security which do need to be met, but after that, people can kind of get wealthier and wealthier, but they don't get any happier. There's been all sorts of long-term surveys in different societies of happiness. I remember reading about one in America where they tracked people's assessment of their happiness over decades. And happiness peaked in about 1957. And since then in America, people have got more and more wealthy, particularly the people at the top. People's expectations or perceptions of what they need to be happier have just got higher and higher, but nobody's got any happier. If anything, people are sort of slightly less happier, slightly more stressed than they were in earlier times. So I think there's a kind of clear message that happiness does not come from wealth, from status, and from possessions, beyond a certain kind of basic point of those kind of basic needs and basic security that we do need. Real happiness comes from meaning and belonging. It comes from having a sense of meaning and a sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself. So for me, yeah, this is again something that Buddhism can speak to. I think that Buddhism is very much about that shift, that fundamental shift in attitudes that I was talking about yesterday. The kind of basic Buddhist insight of moving from living your life in terms of what can I get, what's in it for me, that shift to living your life on the basis of what can I give, what can I offer, what can I contribute. And I think that very much speaks to what the world needs. The world needs a sense of common purpose, a sense of how we can work for the common good, and that actually that's what's really going to give us a sense of happiness, a sense of meaning, a sense of belonging. That needs to be a much, much stronger ideal in society. Again, in some ways, I think in society in the last 40 years, it's become much more individualistic. And there's not such a strong sense of working for the common good, being a kind of community. I mean, I think we had it to some extent at the start of the pandemic, didn't we? It kind of came out, a sense of kind of being in this together. And people really sort of noticed that and thought that was a really positive development. And then for various reasons, it's kind of weakened again. And we're back in a situation where things feel quite divided and fractious. So this is a big topic. But for me, it's underlaid again by a spiritual value of community, of serving something, of living your life in terms of what can I give, rather than what's in it for me. And seeing that real happiness comes from having something that gives you meaning and a sense of belonging. And that can be all sorts of things. It can be your family, it can be your community, it can be your work, which might be a vocation for you, it might be a cause that you feel really passionate for. But yes, having something bigger than you that you're kind of pouring your life into, your energies into, that's where real happiness and meaning and belonging comes from. Yeah. And again, I think this is something Tri Ratna can offer because we're quite good at community. Over the last 50 years, I think we've learnt quite a lot about how to build community, how to build something based around a common purpose, a common good. I think we've learnt a lot of skills. We're by no means perfect, but we've learnt a lot of skills about how to build communities around consensus, around people working in teams together and really kind of contributing together and so on. So this is another area where I think the Dharma can kind of speak to what's going on in the world, and we've got certain skills and experience that we can offer the world. So last area I want to talk about, and then I'll wrap up, is the strapline is wisdom. In an age of information overload, we need more wisdom. In an age of information overload, we need more wisdom. So, yeah, again, what's happened in the world has been globalization, massive technological change, and so on. The world is so complicated. That's, I suppose, one of the characteristics of modern life, that we're not just living in a kind of little locality, little local community. We live in a global world, and we're surrounded by hugely complicated, fast-changing issues, and nobody can hope to understand it all. The politicians might pretend to, but there's no way any one person can understand it all. It's a kind of very, very complex, fast-changing world that we live in. And I think one of the things that this creates is a sense of bewilderment. I think, probably deep down, millions and millions of people just have a sense of bewilderment, of not knowing what to think, of just being confused by what's going on in the world. Yeah? And bewilderment, I guess, breeds angst. It breeds a kind of deep, generalised sense of anxiety. I think there's a kind of modern angst that goes with living in a kind of complex global world. And when that angst goes on for a long time, well, of course, people respond in different ways. So maybe one way to respond is with anger and rage, jumping on bandwagons, feeling resentful towards others, and so on, yeah? Maybe another way to respond is conspiracy theories. So, you know, that's a bit of a recent phenomenon, isn't it? The increase, massive increase in conspiracy theories and people signing up to conspiracy theories. And maybe another way people respond is with apathy. It just feels too much, and so people withdraw and disengage and become more apathetic and so on. So in such a world, we need wisdom. Yeah. In a world of information overload, in a way what's needed is less information and more wisdom. What we need is a deeper perspective, deeper kind of wisdom teachings, deeper perspectives, which help us sort of orientate in this complicated, fast-changing world. Yeah. So sort of deeper principles that aren't so fast changing, that we can kind of ground ourselves in, which kind of, yeah, allow us to orientate ourselves in a complicated world. So yeah, wisdom is different to information. It's different even to knowledge. You know, you need some of those, but in a way, the ratio needs to be switched around. We're overwhelmed with information. We need more wisdom. We need to be kind of grounded in those perspectives, those Dharma teachings, Dharma perspectives, which help us to stay grounded and orientated in a complicated, angst-ridden world. Yeah. And somebody in my study group yesterday was talking about how they came to the Dharma in a time of suffering in their life. And she said that she found the Dharma teachings that she encountered helped give her suffering kind of meaning. Yeah. So through encountering the Dharma, what was happening started to have a kind of meaning. Yeah. So maybe she could see that this was just part of her life and she had to kind of use it as a way of growing and understanding herself and understanding the world more deeply, as it were. So yeah, encountering the Dharma gave that suffering more meaning. Yeah. So it didn't take it away. It was still suffering, maybe. It was still perhaps quite difficult. But it changed her relationship to it. It suddenly had meaning. She suddenly was able to kind of orientate herself in relationship to it and know what she needed to do, you know, in order to sort of move forward in a kind of human, creative kind of way. So this is what we need in an age of information overload. Is we really need those wisdom teachings which can give us that meaning and ability to orientate ourselves. Okay, so I'm just going to wrap up for 5 minutes and I'm going to try and briefly connect the two halves of the talk. So I've been talking about qualities or Dharma principles which I think have a certain social implication. They kind of speak to what's going on in society in a certain kind of way. So I've talked about metta, loving kindness. I've talked about community and serving something bigger than ourselves. And I've talked about wisdom in an age of information overlooked. So those qualities, metta, service, wisdom, they can only be developed by individuals. It's only individual people, through their choice, through their kind of effort, through their practice, that are going to be able to develop those qualities and make them real, make them manifest in the world. Buddhism can't do it. Buddhism can only become real through individual people choosing to kind of develop themselves and wanting to kind of grow and express those qualities more fully in their lives. Yeah. It'd be no use us forming the Buddhist People's Party and having a manifesto in which we say we're going to pass a law, on loving kindness or something like that. That would be absolutely, it wouldn't make any difference whatsoever. Yeah. These are just things that people, individuals, have to live and have to become. Yeah. So in other words, it starts with individual transformation and individual growth. Yeah. It starts with our own personal practice. So here's a little quote from Rumi. He said, "Yesterday I was clever, so I wanted to change the world. Today I am wise, so I've begun to change myself." So that is where it needs to start. We do need to start by changing ourselves, by personal transformation. Yeah? And if we don't do that, our activity in the world is in danger of just becoming part of the problem. You do see that if you look into the arena of politics. You see people active in the world, but just out of anger. And they become polarised and they, yeah, in a way, just become part of the problem. If we don't want that to happen, we have to start with ourselves. We have to start with growing those qualities of loving kindness and wisdom within ourselves, as it were. It has to start with personal transformation. And yet, at the same time, there's people out there who are suffering. There are issues out there that need addressing. So it's not like we can just put the world on hold while we all go off and gain enlightenment. That's not going to work either. So it's a bit like somehow we need to try and do both at once. We need to transform self and transform world. Yeah. We're transforming ourselves so that we're more able to play a kind of creative, helpful role in the world. We're more able to contribute to transforming world. And we're transforming the world as a response to others, but also we make that our context or our practice for transforming self. By being out there in the world, we come up against our limitations, and that can become the means by which we're able to transform ourselves as well more deeply, and so that we can even help the world even more fully and deeply, as it were. So we're trying to do both, transforming self and transforming world. And you could say that transforming self is the dimension of depth, linking back to that earlier diagram. Transforming self is the dimension of depth. Yeah, it's looking into myself, looking into my mind and my heart, seeing what needs to be transformed, deeply trying to kind of orientate my life towards enlightenment, as it were. So that's the dimension of depth. Whereas transforming world is the dimension of breadth. That's the dimension of looking out, reaching out to those around us, as it were. So in other words, we can link this to that model of Sangha that I was talking about earlier. That model of Sangha shows how we can all help each other transform self and transform world. Yeah? Some of us are helping more with the depth end of the kind of spectrum. Some of us are helping more with the kind of breadth end of the spectrum. But by having the whole thing working together, being stronger together, we're able to offer something which has got the kind of the depth and the breadth to be able to transform self and transform world. So it's showing us how we all make a contribution by living our different Buddhist lifestyles, by practicing the Dharma in different ways. We're contributing to the overall health, spiritual health of a Sangha, which then allows for that breadth and that depth, which allows for the transformation of self and world. Yeah? So it's showing how a Sangha can make a contribution in some way to the spiritual health of a culture, of a society, which is the necessary kind of roots or foundations of underpinning for the social health, political health even, of a society or a culture or a nation. So it's showing how the Sangha can be the Bodhisattva in the world, as it were. So that's what we're trying to do. We've got this massive big vision, and we're just a tiny little community, a small community with a big vision. But hey, why have a small vision? If you're going to have a vision, you might as well have a big one. And it's important to remember we're not alone. There are many other communities out there with similar visions, trying to kind of contribute to the spiritual, moral, ethical foundations of a society in this kind of way. So there you go. That's my talk. A few reflections on how we create Sangha as a gift to each other, all contributing in our different ways, contributing to the overall spiritual vitality of the Sangha. And if we do that, we also create a Sangha which can be a gift to the world, which can contribute something to the kind of spiritual values which are actually a necessary foundation for a kind of decent, humane, good society. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Vajragupta. I'm sure many of us will be wanting to sort of pass on our gratitude for that talk. I think there's a lot in it for us to digest as a community, and I hope we'll be picking up these reflections, you know, over the next few months, I imagine, if not longer. It felt like a very important talk where I was sitting, and I could feel myself coming with some new ways of looking at things, which feel very helpful. Thank you very much. We're going to go into breakout groups now. We're going to have a break now. So, have a bit of a pause. But if we could aim to come back at 5:02, that would be really helpful. So if we can be back at 5:12, ready for our breakout groups, please. Thank you.